introduction like that, that it would not be right for me to say, "Here I am." But in fact, at the age of being a tottering old ruin as I am, it's difficult to get such an introduction and then disappoint you this terribly. Anyway, let's all pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Friend, beloved God,
Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, we bow to all of you. Divine Mother,
we are thy children,
naughty or good.
We are thine.
Make us one with thee.
Make us one with thee.
Om peace.
Amen.
Please be seated. Well, I want to say welcome to all of you. I'm delighted to have you here. And why it should be that at the age of 84, when most people do speak in sort of a rattling voice, my voice should have gotten stronger and heavier and more vital over the years, such that now it's also become deeper. I've actually hit the lowest note on the piano. God knows how. But anyway, I hope I'm not talking so deep that only the whales could understand me. It's a delight to be with you, and thank you for coming. I came to Los Angeles wanting, above all, to help people to understand what Paramahansa Yogananda really was like. Nowadays, there's nobody teaching in public who knew him personally. And a tradition has been growing that he was a very stern disciplinarian, hard to live with, difficult to take, all sorts of impossible images that were simply not true. I lived with him for 3.5 years. I found him the most lovable and loving, the most human, the most wonderfully humorous, the most genuinely human being that I have ever known. And it pains me that some people, they want to show how great they were by demonstrating how well they were able to take his discipline. Surely he disciplined us. We needed it. People think that when they get out of school or college, that then they've had their education. All of life should be an education. We were born in this world to learn, and we should never stop learning until the last breath we take, and even that is a part of our school. It would be very good to keep in mind that you have a final exam to face, and that final exam is death. And what will have happened to you in this life at the end of it will seem very unimportant. A friend of mine once, he became a monk and a disciple of Yogananda. But what brought him first to the path was he almost drowned. And he was just going down for the third time when somehow he was able to catch a branch and hold on to it. But he said his whole life passed before his eyes in that moment. And what he found was very interesting was that the things that he had thought were important in his life were not important at all. And many things that he had sort of tossed off as not important were very important. Remember, they say you can't take it with you, but there are certain things you can take with you. They aren't things. Their qualities. If you treat every opportunity, every experience as an opportunity to grow spiritually, ask yourself the question, Will this help me prepare for my final exam? If somebody insults me, how do I react? Do I punch him in the eye? Or do I stop and think that a punch in the eye will not make me happier? May make my ego more satisfied, but it won't make me happier. Whereas if I can thank him and say, I appreciate your words because they help me to affirm how very unimportant I am in the general scheme of things. I've always found it ridiculous, the habit people used to have of dueling over silly issues and willing to kill each other for those same silly issues, when it simply doesn't matter what other people think of you. I think this is one of the things that has helped me to be possibly a decent lecturer, is the fact that I have never much cared what people thought of me. I figured that they're usually wrong anyway. And so, from that point of view, it doesn't matter. But from another point of view, what doesn't matter is that what does matter is the truth. And if their opinions of me are true, fine. But if they're good, they may or may not be true. In fact, it is sometimes a help to really get a good knock in the teeth sometimes. I remember one occasion, it was really the low point of my public speaking career, and I embraced it with joy. What happened was this. I was supposed to go to Vancouver and give a big lecture there. I was the center department head in Self-Realization Fellowship. And the leader of our small group in Bremerton, Washington, wrote and said she was planning a big lecture for me. I had told them that I wanted to come by and meditate with them a bit. And she wrote and said that, no, they were planning this big lecture. Well, I knew she knew absolutely nothing about planning a lecture. So I phoned her and I said, please, let's not have a lecture. Let me do what I was saying and just meditate a while. Oh, no, everything is all arranged and we have the hall and everything. So I thought, well, I knew it would be a disaster, which of course it was. I knew it would be a disaster. And I thought, well, we need a few disasters in our lives, so it doesn't really matter. And she met me, mind you, Bremerton, you had to get to it by ferry. So it's not the sort of place you could just drive up to from anywhere else. It was on an island. And she met me at the ferry, and as we were going in the car, I said, well, what have you done to advertise this event? And she proudly showed me a little one-by-one ad in their local paper. It said, special meeting, SRF members. Well, can you imagine? Didn't even say Self-Realization Fellowship members. Who knows what SRF means? I said, do you think this will draw people? Oh, yes, yes. Well, I just smiled. It didn't matter to me one bit or the other. I mean, I've always felt that if people think I'm a fool, and I am a fool, what does it matter? If I am a fool, what does it matter if they know it? And if I'm not? If I'm not, then it's not true anyway, so why worry about it? But I said, did you do anything else? Oh, yes, yes, I gave an announcement to the newspaper, to the radio station, so that it could talk about this. So I said, did you give it to somebody in particular? Oh, no, no, I didn't. There was nobody there. So I just left it on the desk. Well, I can imagine what that would mean. Anyway, the big night approached, and there was the hall was, I think, big enough for 50 or 100 people. And the front row was taken up with everybody in the audience was Signe Schultz. She was our She was the center leader there. In case I forgot to say her name, her relatives, who had come out of a grim sense of loyalty to her because she had browbeat them into coming. So the front row was full of little children squirming and giggling. Just behind them, there was a lady listening, and she had a book, a little tiny book she was reading. Turning the pages surreptitiously. Behind her, there was another man after several empty seats, and he kept shaking his watch, wondering. And Signe Schultz all the time was looking, smiling like this, not listening to a word I said, just concentrating on encouraging her relatives. And then there were the three members of the center there. They obviously had to come, so they did. And then, well, Signe Schultz was one of them, so the two members. Then there was one other who came, who was a friend of theirs, who came out of mild curiosity to their meetings. And she was the only person who wasn't an SRF member, but was thinking of becoming one. Well, anyway, I never worked so hard to give a good lecture. All my jokes fell completely flat. Nobody knew what I was talking about. And the whole thing was, of course, as I had expected, a complete fiasco. Besides which, it rained heavily. So anyway, at the end of it, the Signe Schultz said to me, "Oh, I know many more people would have come, except that Gaylord Houser was speaking in town tonight. He was a famous health lecturer. And this one member who had come, who wasn't a member, this one person who had was a member of the audience, but not of anything else, and she had come out of perhaps mild curiosity. She overheard Signe Schultz say that Gaylord Houser was speaking, and she said, "Oh dear, you mean it was tonight?" And I thought, this is marvelous. I can never sink lower than this. Everything from now on will be upward. And so that was my great, great success in Bremerton, Washington. I've never gone back. If I went out, I might be ridden out of town on a rail. I don't know. But, you know, it doesn't matter what people think. It doesn't matter. You must remember that the important thing that you can gain here is right attitude in the face of everything that comes to you, whatever it may be. Watch yourself carefully. Now, the center of ego is right here. You've noticed how people, when they're proud, they look down their noses at everybody. When you feel ego, you feel it gathering here. It causes tension here and draws your head back. Now, watch any kind of touch of feeling. If you feel it here, then try to relax that and direct it here to this point. This is a very good, very valid technique for transcending egotism. The feeling of ego, if ever you feel yourself either offended or flattered, you know when somebody flatters you and you... That's because your center of ego is here. And so you're feeling your center here. Watch rock stars when they're singing. It's really quite funny when you know these things and you can watch the human parade as it goes. Some people just all the time. But if you can understand these things, then watch yourself. Turn everything that you see, not to criticism, which is ridiculous. You gain nothing from criticizing, but say, "I must watch for that in myself." Now that will be a treasure you can take with you when you leave this body. The goal of the spiritual path, finally speaking, is to get rid of this sense of ego. Why is that so? Well, let me try to put it back to the origins. God, when he created the universe, had to create it in a particular way. He didn't do it like we do, the way we do. Forgive me, I'm too strong on the importance of right grammar. So I made the wrong mistake when I said, like we do. Anyway, the way we do is mold a thing from outside. You mustn't do that. Feel that God, you mustn't think God does that. He became it. How did he become it? Well, you know, these things could not be taught until very recently. It just seemed too obvious that matter was real, that matter could never be changed from being matter. And the saying that the matter can neither be created nor destroyed seemed an absolute reality. But now we know, with the explosion of the atom bomb, we know that the matter can be converted into energy. The truth of it is that energy was what manifested the material world. The material world has no actual substance. It's made of energy. But where did the energy come from? It came from thoughts. And where did those thoughts come from? Where did they come from? They came from the infinite. God, when he dreamed this universe, dreamed it into existence first as thoughts. And he thought that everything, as it says in the Bible, he saw that it was good, and then he was ready to do more. So God manifested first the causal universe. And from the causal universe, he manifested the astral world. It's to the astral world that you go when you die. You are not free in your soul when you leave your body, because you still are encased in a body of energy. And that energy body is encased in a body of thoughts. And to become really free, to the point of being able to become one with God, you must escape from all three of these bodies, and then you merge into him. And one who becomes one with God becomes literally one with him. In other words, he becomes God. You can never say that the wave is the ocean, but you can say that the wave merges back into the ocean and there is no distinction. And when it comes to consciousness, they're not little atoms of ocean water dispersing only to their own little space in the vast ocean. When it comes to consciousness, you become all that there is. This is a state of consciousness almost beyond human conception. When you achieve that, you become like Jesus Christ. You become like Buddha, like Shankara, like Yogananda. And I must say that living with Yogananda was for me, in a sense, an awe-inspiring experience. Because, yes, he had a delightful sense of humor. Yes, he had delightful human qualities. But you could see beyond that that there were none of them. They didn't define him. I would look into his eyes, and I would see the depth there. And I would see that there was no ego. Nothing directing his thoughts with any likes or dislikes. He had no likes or dislikes. He accepted whatever came. And he could have been thrown into a dungeon. He could have been shot, attacked, beaten up. It wouldn't have mattered to him. He was not touched by anything. And yet you could also see disappearing lakes into the distance. Lakes of joy. I would look into his eyes and see so much love, so much joy. And you felt, I remember this one time, and I've told you this story before, beautiful story. I was sitting at his feet, and he was editing the Bhagavad Gita. I had helped editing it with him, and Perhaps he was going over some of my suggestions, I don't know. But at any rate, he was working on it. And I was sitting there and I was thinking how wonderful it is to be his disciple and to be with somebody who knows God, with somebody who is one with God, with somebody who knows my deepest thoughts. And in fact, I remember him one time saying to me, "I know every single thought you think." That's an inconceivable thing. And yet he proved it to me again and again. Some little thought that I had always, his correction almost always, had to do with how I presented myself to other people, because he had told me that my work was teaching and representing his teachings to the world. But always he knew my least little flicker of ideas. One time, for example, I used to pray to him, "Help me to love you the way you love me." And in a little discussion with a group of us, he looked at me and he said, "How can the little cup hold the whole ocean?" Well, I understood what he meant. How could I begin to love him the way he loved me when he loved with the love of the oceanic love of God himself? I could only love with my little human heart. But what love I had, I gave to him. And I remember thinking this time on that one occasion how fortunate I was to be his disciple. And when he'd finished his job, he asked me to help him up to his feet. And he looked at me very close, just this close. And he said, "Just a bulge of the ocean." People forget that the real importance of his life was not him as an individual. It was the principle he represented, the principle of oneness with God. He never talked of himself as important. He spoke of God. "I'm just here. I'm not your guru." He said, "God is the guru." He never accepted praise for himself. He said, "God is the doer." Or whatever he did, he said, "God made me say that." But it was always a principle that he represented. And in a way, we do him an injustice to talk about him as an individual, because he was so much more than that. And all the beautiful positive thoughts that people develop in their lives, they're important. It's important to know that you can do whatever you put your will to. It's very important. But it's even better to know that such things as The Secret, you will, all of you know that movie and book. It's important to know that although those things are true, there's a much greater power behind them that is accountable for the whole universe. The more you act as an instrument for that, the more everything just flows beautifully. Yogananda told of it was a fascinating little story, but he used to enjoy stopping in Laguna Beach on his way down to Encinitas from Mount Washington. And there was a little Scottish tea shop there, and he enjoyed getting Scotch bread. You know, even a master has to have things they enjoy just to hold them down to this body. It's so easy for them to sail off into the infinite. That was why many saints, when they come out of samadhi, the first thing they ask for is a glass of water, or back in the days when people thought smoking was okay, they'll ask for a cigarette or something, just to tie their minds down to this little body again. I remember being with Master out of the desert and having sometimes to hold him so he didn't fall. And he said to me one time, "I'm in all bodies. It's so difficult to remember that this is the body I'm supposed to keep moving." What a state of consciousness to have. But he always had that feeling. He was the great, he was the doer. God is the doer, not Yogananda, but he. So I'm just a bulge of the ocean. The ocean is the reality. We need to think that way too. One time, because Master taught us this, one time somebody, after my lecture in Hollywood Church here in Sunset Boulevard, and this person said to me, that thanked me for my talk and said it was a good talk and so on. I said, well, God is the doer. Really? As if I knew it was good, I didn't know it was that good. Well, that's not what I meant. I meant that he's the one who did it. But there was another experience I had there that was a very instructive one to me. I was in the middle of a lecture when it suddenly occurred to me that I should let God be the doer. Master had told me that I should let God speak through me. And so let me just shut up and let him start talking on his own. So I shut up and waited for him to say something through me. Well, I stood there for 2 minutes. 2 minutes in a room full of people, when you're in the middle of a talk, suddenly not to speak for 2 minutes. That's an unusual situation. People were beginning to perspire, thinking I'd lost my nerve or something. No, I was just comfortably standing there, waiting for God to say something through me. And finally I realized that it wasn't going to happen. For me, it was a very worthwhile experiment. I found that what Yogananda had prayed is the truth. I will reason. I will. I will act. But guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. And indeed, I had to talk, but I had to pray to be guided to say the right things. And from then on, I've always understood. And my feeling as a lecturer, I have never thought of myself as teaching anyone. But it is my privilege to share what little bit I know. And so my teaching is always a kind of sharing. It's never oratory. But I share with people what I have found to be true. And I feel that it's very important to be honest. So if ever I find that I've been wrong, I'll say so perfectly gladly. I have no face to save. I only want people to know the truth. But I feel really this inspiration came to me many, many years ago, that to feel that each person in my audience was really my own guru. Not that I was teaching my guru or sharing with him even, but that each one of them is a soul wanting to understand how to come out of the darkness of suffering and misery. As Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, oh Arjuna, get away from my ocean of suffering and misery. That is what this world is. And you think, oh, I'm not suffering now, so I'm fine. But believe me, suffering can come to everybody, does come to everybody. And sooner or later, when it does come, it seems to take over everything. And you think, why me? Well, why you? It was just your turn, that's all. Everybody gets his chance. Everybody gets his chance to be in misery. This world is, we must understand that the whole thing is just a temporary thing. You think, well, next Christmas is still a long way away. Once it comes, it's gone. And so death seems like it's a long way away. You don't know. You may step out of this theater today and get run over by a car or a truck. You just don't know from one moment to the next how long you will live and how you will die. These things are taken out of your hands by your own karmas of the past. I had a prophecy in India. India is a fantastic country, and you find some incredible things there. But one is a book, in fact, there are more than one book, in which your life is described. It may be your life, it may not be, but some people's lives are found there. Mine was found there. It said in this thing that I was a disciple of Yogananda. My name is Kriyananda. I was a seer of Ashtanga Yoga and traveling in the world. I was from a Western family. Different things. It talked about the past. It talked about the future in a sort of a vague way. But it intrigued me enough so that when I heard that there was another segment of the same book available through a home in New Delhi, that I went there a couple of months later. And there it said that I've already given him a reading in what it was called my Yogavalli. And it said a person has many lifetimes to live. Usually it'll give you your last life, your present life, your future life. And this one said that after saying a person has many lifetimes to live, it took me all the way back to the time of Kurukshetra. And it spoke about certain things that happened that are very interesting, yes, but how was I to know that they were true? Then it said, in this life, he was born in Romania, grew up in America, his father named him James. Well, these are unusual things. But in fact, I was born in Romania. I did grow up in America from the age of 13 onward. My father actually named me James Donald Walters, but I always went by the name Donald. And so nobody knew the name James. And yet here it said James. It spoke about having brothers, but no sister is possible, though one sister will die in his mother's womb. And when I got home to America, I asked my mother if I if she'd ever had a miscarriage, because of course I'd never heard that she had. She said, yes, she did have one. But intriguing things, it said, and all of them true. And then it spoke about the future, and it said these are the fruits of his good karmas, and it spoke about meeting Yogananda, my monastic name becoming Kriyananda, and it spoke about my lecturing, etc., etc. Then it said, and I have told him the fruits of his good karmas, here are the fruits of his bad karmas. There is a danger, all of a sudden, of instantaneous death. And then it talked about certain other problems, all of which have come true. And it said, when it talked about the death, well, there are three times in my life when I could easily have died just like that. The first was I was out in the desert walking, and this flock of crows were flying right around my head. And I thought, well, this can't be a good omen. And when I got 2 days later, when I got ready to go back to Los Angeles, I was out at 29 Palms, and I unmade my bed. I found between the two sheets a squashed black widow spider. But evidently in my sleep I had turned over and squashed it. But there was certainly the danger there of instantaneous death. Then a little later in India, in the town of Puri, I was setting up a microphone for Dayamata to speak on Master's birthday, and I grabbed the microphone like this, the boom, when all of a sudden the short circuit occurred and a current went all the way through my body, lifted me off the ground, and froze my fingers. So there was nothing I could have done. It was certain death. The current there is 230 volts. And instead, suddenly the fuse blew. So again, I was given the grace of being saved. And the third time was that in Italy, I had bought a Lambretta, you know, a little motor scooter. And I had shipped it to India, thinking I could save on gas that way. And actually, it's just as well that I never did use it, because everybody used to laugh himself sick looking at me driving that thing. Anyway, I won't go into that part of it. And I took it out of its crate when it arrived, and I turned the key on in the lock, sitting in the seat, not realizing that it was in gear. And as soon as I turned it on, I went out like that. I was inside a brick-enclosed courtyard, and I had a split second to figure out what to do about it. I'd never been on a Lambretta before. I didn't know the machine. But somehow, with God's grace, I was able to find the neutral, the gear thing, and put it in neutral and put my foot on the brake. And I stopped that close to the wall. So three times in my life, I could easily have faced instantaneous death. So everything about that prophecy turned out to be the truth. And I have to assume it's what it spoke about in the past was true too. But such an interesting thing. India really is it's a very fascinating country. You go there now, you see all the modern things, and it seems like just another country of our times. But for example, there's a temple. I forget the name of it. It may be Mahabalipuram, but it also may not, so I won't insist. And there is a legend of a couple of saints who committed some sin and were cursed to be birds for a certain number of ages. And you hear these myths all over the world. There's nothing to them. So you sort of take it for granted that, yes, this is another one of those myths, except for the fact that there are only two birds. There have never been three. There's never one. It's always the same birds. They keep coming back for lunch every day, and you see them coming and leaving. But it's been going on for hundreds of years. I say no other country besides India produces such weird experiences. There is one just across the bridge from Delhi, in a town called Sabzi Mandi. In Sabzi Mandi, they were digging to build something when they came upon some resistance. So they dug around the resistance, and they found a yogi seated in lotus pose under the ground. And they were able to somehow bring him back to consciousness outwardly. And he talked to them. Nobody understood him, so they got a pundit and a Sanskrit scholar. And the Sanskrit scholar said he's speaking a very ancient type of Sanskrit. I can barely understand him, but they were able to converse some. And he said, what yuga is this? Well, in India they have the belief now that it's Kali Yuga, which is the darkest age. Actually, it is not. It's Dwapara, but they said it's Kali Yuga. And he said, well, I'm not interested. And once you've come back to your body after being out of it for so long, then you can't keep your body anymore. Actually, it's the Divine Mother's way of making sure that you don't get out of delusion without helping other people also. I know of other cases where Master said that was why these saints were brought back. The three saints that had been found buried under a lake, and they'd been there probably at least 300 years. So where else do you hear stories like that and then find the proof of it? This man said, if you dig over there, you'll see the image before which I used to worship. And then he left his body, and that was that. But only in India. You don't hear many stories like it now, but they're all there. At any rate, God is what manifested the entire universe. And your body is really a manifestation of His consciousness. Now we can understand that much better since science has shown us that matter doesn't have any actual reality of its own. That first of all, there is in your body far more space than there is substance. But even that substance is only energy. And the space between your atoms, your tiny molecules, this is much, much more, it's sort of entirely comparable to going into outer space and seeing the planets and stars around. Vast spaces in between and then a star. Vast spaces, another star. That's what your body is. If it were reduced, if all the space were taken out from between the solid particles in your body would hardly be visible. It would still weigh the same if you put that little tiny speck of dust in the spoon. It would have the same weight as your present body. But even that much weight is not, and it's not really weight and it's not matter. It's still only energy. So now we can understand that if we are all just waves on this great ocean of energy, the waves change, but the energy remains the same. And so it's possible for us today to say that you and I are one. We're not different from each other. It's just a little wall of self-definition that we've woven around us. And that self-definition added, augmented by all the thoughts that I'm an American, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm rich, I'm poor, I'm old, I'm young, I'm interested in football, I hate football, I like baseball, I hate both, I'd much rather go to the library and read. All the self-definitions people have, people will say, well, as I always say, get rid of that thought. If you want something to take with you when you die, try to think in terms of those things which have caused you to affirm the thought that I'm more important, I'm separate from everybody else. Try to constantly remember that you are just a little manifestation, a little bulge on the ocean. And this is what this particular saying from Yogananda's, my book, Conversations with Yogananda, which I wrote from my memories of being with him. But he said, people spend too much time fussing over their persons and possessions. What a waste of time it is to devote so much energy to polishing this little body, home, and belongings, all of which so very soon will have to be abandoned forever. Remember that. Everything that you have, it is only a possession, starting with your body and going on to everything else. It will have to be relinquished. When you die, you won't be able to pick it up in your hands anymore. Yes, you'll have hands, but they'll be hands of energy. Yes, you'll be a person, but it's a person with a body of energy. You will still have your ego, because ego begins with that form of energy. And so you will be able to say, well, that used to be mine, but you won't be able to say anymore. There was one woman, however, and if you want to try this route, you can. He went to a woman psychic and asked her who he would be in his next life so he could will all his property to that person. Well, with that exception, you have to say you can't take it with you. The wonderful thing about truth is that when you go with it instead of against it, it can give you so much joy, so much satisfaction. When you can go with the facts, then you can think, well, is there nothing I can take with you, with me? Yes, there is. Your acts of kindness, those things which help you to refine your personality, those things which help you to understand that I am happier when I give to other people than when I take from them, that I gain when I give and I actually lose when I take. If you understand that, you can become less burdensome on yourself by not having self-definitions by telling yourself, I'm not an American, I'm not a man or a woman, I don't have an age to lose, I am simply consciousness. If you tell yourself always, you will find amazingly, I talked about The Secret and other very fine books. I had this experience myself in college. I remember I wanted to, I was a student of Greek, that was one of my subjects, and I had absolutely no interest in it. It was just something I had to enroll in, so I did. But I, in studying it, I never went to class, and as the time came for the exam, the professor would say, well, there are some people here who might as well not even come to the exam. And everybody would look at me and laugh because I might recognize in a passage of Greek words like and the, a few things like that, but that's hardly classed me as a master of Greek. But I had no expectation of losing. I knew I'd pass that exam. But my roseate expectations were not met by any effort in the right direction. A week before the exam, I picked up the book and started to study, and I thought, oh, I hate this subject, and I put it down, didn't look at it. I'll do twice as much tomorrow, I told myself. The second day, I'll do three times as much tomorrow. Fourth day, I'll do four times as much. The week ended Sunday night. Monday morning, we were to have the exam, and I hadn't really opened that book once all week. Still, I expected to pass, but I cannot imagine anybody in his right mind endorsing my roseate expectations. And then suddenly I was hit with an inspiration. I said, you're a Greek. All of a sudden, I felt that I was a Greek. And I felt that I could easily tune into my own language. And so for 2 hours, I studied, really absorbing everything like a dry sponge in water, and until my brain just wouldn't hold anymore. Anyway, the next day, it was an unusually difficult exam. I'm telling you the truth. Only two people in that class passed the exam, and I was one of them. How, I don't know. But positive thinking can do incredible things for you. I found that as long as I had that theory, and I still have it, so I can't say that I ever lost it, I realized that there's a great deal that I can do. But there's no sweetness in it, because it makes you feel puffed up. I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. What's the gain in that? I'm such a small little entity. Whereas if you understand that your own power is linked to the power of the universe, and the only degree to which you can use these laws is that degree to which you attune yourself to that larger power. The more you put yourself in his hands, the more you're amazed to find that God does take care of you. I started to tell you that story of Yogananda when he went to Laguna Beach and enjoyed the Scotch bread. One day he went by there and stopped, and one of his secretary went in and came back with the news that they're sorry, but they're all out of it at this time. And he was so surprised. It's not that he had the desire. It's not that he was disappointed, but he had never been led by Divine Mother to do something which didn't come true. And so he just said, Divine Mother, how come? And all of a sudden he saw this bolt of light coming down onto the building. And a moment later the proprietress came out and she said, wait. She said, I happen to have an order here which I've set aside for somebody, but I can make him another batch. I want you to have this one. And so the Divine Mother took over even when he didn't mind, he didn't care, but he put it in her hands. I have seen in this way that some wonderful things can happen. And it's even more wonderful when it's on a trivial level. In other words, it isn't that God needs you and so save your life. It's rather something like you don't even need it yourself. And yet, because you ask him, he helps you out. Master said, Divine Mother, how come? She's the one who corrected it. He wouldn't have done that. One time when I was in at Mount Washington, my parents lived in Bordeaux, France. My father was an oil geologist, and he was sent there to be the representative for discovering oil there. And I had gone to school in Switzerland, so I always remembered how much I enjoyed Swiss chocolate. And I thought, well, Bordeaux is a lot closer to Switzerland than I am. It would be lovely if I could ask them to send me some Swiss chocolates. But when I wrote, which was seldom, I always forgot to mention these Swiss chocolates. And a week before my birthday, I thought, oh, Divine Mother, it's a pity I didn't think of it, because it would have been nice to have it for my birthday. The day before my birthday, I got a package from somebody in the church who had said I was passing a store and I saw these Swiss chocolates. I don't know if you like chocolate, but I just thought of you and felt the desire to buy these Swiss chocolates for you. And she sent me a box, which I shared with everybody. But I was so thrilled to think that the Divine Mother would come through on such a trivial subject as that, just because I had given it into her hands. Try to live your life in such a way as to expand your sense of self to include a much, much greater reality. You can make this life actually a doorway to the infinite. You can achieve the highest state of freedom in this life if you will only make the effort to do so. So as you live your life, so will you find that you pass your final exam but with flying colors. When the day comes for you to leave this body, instead of clinging to the body, which you can't cling to anyway, you'll find yourself freed from everything. It will be for you a glorious moment. This doorway can be a doorway to darkness and future bondage, or a doorway to light. Just reflect how short life is, how uncertain its length is, and reflect that everything that you have now must be taken away from you. It would be a good practice every night to make a bonfire mentally of everything and just throw into that bonfire every attachment, every desire, every human or physical or material longing, and say, I don't need you, I'm free from you. Try to go to sleep every night with that thought that I am free. I want nothing. I want only thee. I would like to ask if you have any questions you would like to ask. Now, mind you, I'm deaf as a post, so without the help of somebody who will come up, I won't be able to hear your questions. So thank you, Jyotish. So,
could you tell us more about Paramahansa Yogananda as far as his character qualities and what he was like, please?
Could you tell us more about Paramahansa Yogananda as far as his character qualities and what he was like?
You know, for one thing I have to say, there is a saying in India that the guru is Trigunarahitam, beyond the three gunas. You cannot really say that a master like him has personality qualities. You can't define them in that way. But his consciousness manifests in certain ways, and in each one it will be unique. His unique expression was really very interesting, inasmuch as most sages are sort of very removed. They don't want to get involved in attachment, and so they tend to be impersonal in their treatment of others and everything. Master wasn't like that. He was completely free. He wore his wisdom sort of like a comfortable old jacket. He just was wise. He didn't have to make an effort to maintain his wisdom. And so as he manifested himself to me, first of all, as I said in the beginning, I was always in awe of him because I could see how much greater he was than I. And even when he was joking, he seemed somehow so far above everything. When I looked into his eyes, I saw that he wasn't touched by anything. The night before he left his body, and he said that Divine Mother is, somebody had sent him some green coconuts from Florida, and he was saying that Divine Mother is satisfying this last little desire. It wasn't a desire, it was just a thought that this is one thing that he had enjoyed as a child. But what I remember is that he was laughing and gleefully. He said, "And now for the juice," and he was seemed so eager to enjoy this juice of the coconut. And I looked into his eyes, and they were just, he was completely untouched by it. He was putting on sort of an act. And as soon as I saw that, and I realized that's not he, then he became very serious, and he said, "I have a big day tomorrow, wish me luck." And he left the group then. And the next day is when he left his body. But I always, I couldn't help it. One time, several times, he would be laughing so hard the tears would stream down his cheeks. But somehow in his presence I just felt this overwhelming love and bliss. I can't describe it. But I've had a laser surgery on my eyes, so now I can see very well. But before that, I couldn't see clearly what people's expressions were across the room. But I remember leaving his presence sometimes when I had to, and just turning back to say goodbye, and this wave of love would come over me. It brought tears to my eyes. But that love was a very strong part of his nature. I think more strong than anything else was his bliss. Sometimes he could be discussing the most mundane jobs that needed to be doing, like filling in the potholes in the driveway and so on. And I would just feel this bliss coming over me. It really, I can't begin to describe something that even in the memory makes my eyes fill with tears. He was so absolutely perfect as a human being, completely self-giving, completely unconditional in his love. No matter how people treated him, I remember this one boy who wrote him a very scathing letter of criticism, just projecting his own faults onto Master. And Master said to him quite respectfully, "You should take up writing. That's the best letter Satan ever wrote me." But he meant it. He wasn't being sarcastic. He was always genuine. He was never sarcastic. But he was so respectful. This human being, who of all the human beings in my life that I've ever met, demanded our total respect, in fact, deep awe and admiration. He showed such perfect respect for everyone else. And his only desire was to help to uplift other people. He didn't care what you said about him. He didn't care what you thought of him. It wasn't his interest. But you begin to ask me, what is the ocean like? And how can I tell you? It's everything. So you ask me, what was Yogananda like? And I give you little snippets here and there. But I can't begin to describe the greatness of the man, because he was no longer a man. He was that infinite consciousness manifested in this form. One thing I noticed was that though he had a great sense of humor, if he didn't feel like laughing, nothing could make him smile even. There were times when he was very serious, but never did I find him inappropriate in anything. If ever he didn't live up to my ideals of greatness, it was because his own greatness was so much higher than those ideals. I can't begin to tell you what an experience it was being with him, except to say that in his presence, I felt constantly uplifted. Any other questions?
Yes, Swami, I'm particularly touched by the passage you read today. I have a friend who owes me money, and I've let that go. I realize that dwelling on that debt is a waste of time for me, and I thank you for validating that. My question is the same friend. If she wants to associate with me, break bread with me, do things with me, do I have your endorsement that this is a good thing to do? This is a relationship, and to treat her, continue to treat her with respect. Do I have your blessing for that?
I couldn't hear well.
Same friend, a woman, wants to start forming a relationship, and he wants to know whether he has your blessing to start that relationship or not.
Well, I think it'll probably prove into a disaster. So by all means, go ahead and find out. I'm sorry, I might be wrong, and I'm willing to be wrong. But I would say that it was not begun very auspiciously. Any other questions?
Just for a moment, we just got an announcement here. There is a green Volvo with a surfboard on the roof parked on Clinton Street that is going to be towed. So if that's yours, you might want to do something about it.
Any other questions? Yes.
Swamiji, you've spoken many times about Master's conversation in Beverly Hills regarding starting spiritual communities and dotting them all over the globe. Were there any attempts while Master was in his body for this to happen, or is yours the first attempt to do so?
Were there any attempts while Master was in his body to form a World Brotherhood community, or is yours the first attempt?
He tried it himself, and he failed. He failed because people were coming out of the Depression years then. There were many things that he tried that could not be done at that time, but he tried them in order to show that that's what he really wanted to do. And in this case, people after the Depression were tending to think us four and no more, and trying to get their family together. Now in this depression, and I have to say that it is a depression, and it will get much, much worse, and the government may make all the claims it wants to, but they're lying. The economy is in very bad shape and bound to get much worse. At any rate, now people are thinking more in terms of how to become better human beings. We're living in a different era now. In those days, people weren't ready, and so he had to give up on that attempt. Frankly, I can't help thinking that one thing that blocked it was the nuns, but that's a personal opinion, therefore it's not one that I will pursue. But mine was the first attempt, really, to do anything that was able to succeed. Any other questions?
Thank you, Swami. I have a question for you. If I'm possessed with evil spirits, how can I get rid of them?
Well, if you know, there's a technique he told us. Join your hands, stand by your bed at night before going to bed. Join them in front and in back, and create a circle of light around your body, and use the mantra Om Tat Sat. Om Tat Sat. Say that several times. Then when you go to bed, write Om on your pillow with your finger, so it doesn't leave a mark, but you've written the thought there, and feel that you're going to sleep in God. Such things do take place, and I will not deny it. I myself have had experiences with them, but God's power is greater than any. I remember one time when I was being attacked in such a way, and I called out, Master. Instantly it went away. So remember also that there are great masters in this world, and I'm not trying to convert people to this path. I want you all to know that. I'm trying to convert you to your own higher self. The path you take has to be your choice. But if you're a follower of Yogananda, take his name and ask him to help to free you from this. It can be done. It's something that does happen on the path. It's unfortunate, but don't give in to it by being afraid of it. It's just another entity, and any more than you would not want to give power to a mafioso, so you don't want to give power to these things. The power that can convert them, that can at least protect you, is your devotion to God. Okay?
Swamiji, could you tell any stories of your memories of Durga Ma and Rajasi?
Could you tell any stories of your memories of Durga Ma and Rajasi?
I tell you the truth. I had great respect for Durga Ma. And in fact, after my dismissal, we became closer. But she was a very peppery person, and my experience was not necessarily one I would care to share.
Now you've got them intrigued.
Now I've got them intrigued. But anyway, she was very, very energetic. One time, Master told us that they were painting the sides of the building. The whole building needed repainting. And the monks were there, sort of. She was there. She really put energy into everything she did. And in this, she was a complete delight. She was a very great soul. Master told me about her when I first met her. I said, "You have come." And he recognized that she was his own. So, you know, the monks didn't have much to do with the nuns, and I very rarely got to talk with her. But when I did, I have to say what I really liked about her more than anything else, even when it was directed against me, was her energy. She had a lot of it. And it takes that kind of energy to find God. Don't think that saintly people are necessarily wimps. In fact, they never are wimps. It takes lots of strength of will. When Teresa Neumann was a young maiden on the farm in Germany, and young swains would come around to court her, she would drive them off the farm with a pitchfork. And this is much more typical of the saints than people would realize. Saints can be really quite fierce sometimes. And what I've discovered is that the more you have of bliss, the more you become very decisive in whatever you do. It isn't that you become only soft-edged. Master could be very fierce sometimes, but always it was the expression of his bliss, not of some ego-centered quality. So Durga Mata was not one I got to meet much. Rajasi I got to meet some. It was wonderful being with him because he didn't speak much. He had no small talk, you might say. At a party, I remember I was sitting next to him at a banquet, and he didn't say a word. He just didn't have the gift of small talk. And I do, fortunately for me, but he did not. And I remember he would just quietly smile when things went a little differently from what you might ideally expect. He would just smile. It didn't matter to him. There's one woman who somehow managed to get everybody up chanting and parading around the room, and he just sort of chuckled and said nothing. But every time we'd see him, he would just come over to us and bless us and then leave us. So it was not an outward kind of relationship. I know once he had me drive somewhere, or drive him somewhere, but he just sat next to me and didn't say anything. His way was silence. It was internal, not outward. But his bliss and his utter non-judgment of everybody, these were outstanding qualities in him. And I always held him in great reverence as a supreme human being. Okay? Any other questions?
Hello, Swamiji. I took a course of yours many years ago, Education for Life, and I also read your book before that, obviously, and then I went to the Expanding Light and took the class. And I just wanted to know today, this was 20 years ago when I read your book, but I wanted to know what your thoughts are right now on the educational system in the world, and especially in the United States, and how things have changed, or what are your hopes for the future?
20 years ago, she read Education for Life, and then went to the Expanding Light and took a course in it. And she wants to know, in the intervening 20 years, what are your thoughts now on education in the world, and especially in the United States?
Well, as far as the book is concerned and everything in it, it wasn't my book, it was his. And I really haven't changed any ideas because I think that they were the right ones. I do feel that this system is a very important one. I would like to begin a college teaching education for life to which people could come and get degrees and become educators in the system of education for life, because I think this could be useful. There is a place up in Oregon which was selling for $7 million, now it's selling for $1.5 million. It's very intriguing to me. I'm very attracted, because I would like to have a course in education for life I would like to have our college centered there. I would like to have several of our other teachings, like one that I'm going to be teaching here in Los Angeles very soon on health and happiness in, well, I'm going to call it happiness in six steps or something like that. Six steps to happiness. But it's something that we could make a system of, which people could take around the country the way they took Dale Carnegie's course and have classes and just teaching this aspect of them. And then they would be encouraged to read my entire course, which is 26 lessons long. But all these things are things that I haven't had to refine because they were given to me as Master wanted them to be. And I only feel that the time has justified the need for these teachings. Education for life is a terribly important thing. If children, and we can see the results of our teaching in our own children, how much they have gained from learning how to live and not just how to make money. This is something that will change the world. And I feel very deeply committed to starting these things. So I hope that answers you. I'm very, very much even more keen on it now than I was 20 years ago. Okay?
Just to mention it, there is a course in training for to be a teacher in Education for Life that one of the head teachers of the system is offering over the internet. And if you're interested, you could get a hold of one of us and we can give you an email.
And I should say that everything that I have written is intended to be seminal. In other words, I don't want to give the last final word on anything. I want to offer people suggestive seed thoughts that they themselves can develop into further and further refinements. So I hope that many books will be written on the basis of the books that I've done. I haven't tried, yes, I've tried to give a complete outline, but I've also tried with everything that I've written to open doors to further discussion and further refinement. Okay, any other questions? We have time for one question.
I had two questions, but I'll choose one. well, the two are, I mean, you can decide, Swamiji, right. Which you want to answer.
He has two questions, but you can decide which one you want to answer.
The first question is, Paramahansaji lived through two world wars. Did he ever make any comments about those? And the second question is, did he ever discuss in your presence his guru and his grand guru?
First question is, Master lived through two world wars. Did he ever make comments about those? The second question is, in your presence, did he ever discuss Sri Yukteswar or Lahiri Mahashaya?
He talked about them a great deal. And so that's a simple answer, the first to the second question. The first one, he just said it's part of the bad karma of this planet. He did not completely feel that Germany was at fault. He said that we put Germany in an impossible situation with the Versailles Treaty, and they had to do something. It was, yes, they did it in the wrong way. Yes, there were many faults committed there, but the fault was from two sides. And we, to a large extent, created the situation that ended up in Nazism. And so, He was not for those wars. One war he was for was between South and North Korea. I remember him telling that he himself put the thought in Truman's mind to defend South Korea. Would he have done that in Vietnam? I very greatly doubt it. Vietnam is not a part of America's karma. It didn't need to be. But Korea, if the communists had come into Korea, he spoke of communism as an evil thing in this age, because it's a godless thing. And it tries to emphasize the lower aspects of man rather than the higher. Hammer and sickle, the working man's tools, not those things which man has accomplished that uplift him. And he said that if North Korea took over South Korea, they would come in and take Japan, they would move up into the Aleutian Islands, into Alaska, and they would attack America eventually. So he wanted to stop that at its source. Therefore, he said, I myself put that thought in Truman's mind to defend South Korea. So those are about the only things I remember him discussing with us. Well, that's all the time we have. And I'll meet you all in the lobby. So it's not yet goodbye, but goodbye. God bless you.